Our first conversation begins with Ray Saldanha. Ray is president and CEO of Communities and Schools, the nation's largest dropout prevention organization. Working in more than 3,500 schools and reaching over 2 million students a year. But the place to begin is not Ray's title. Our conversation begins with Ray's experience as a young person on San Antonio's South Side and the relationships that widened what he believed was possible. Ray describes himself at that time as being a very good tightrope walker. His family had limited resources, and he lived in a mixed status household where he learned early to be careful about institutions, questions, and what information felt safe to share. He was doing well enough in school that adults might have seen promise, but much of what shaped Ray's days, worries, and his sense of the future remained out of view. Then Ray met Mrs. Reyes, a communities and school site coordinator. She did not transform his life through a single referral program. She became a consistent presence over several years, with time for questions other adults carrying very large caseloads often could not ask. What do you want? What are you afraid of? What might be possible? Mrs. Reyes understood Ray's cultural and family context, challenged the shame that he carried, and helped him see that his experience contained strength and meaning. Ray's story provides a practical standard for the rest of the episode. Alignment is not successful because several organizations have signed an agreement, or because services exist somewhere in the community. It is successful when a young person experiences support as coherent, respectful, trustworthy, acceptable, and responsive, and when someone accepts the responsibility for helping the pieces to come together. Ray's contribution to our conversation is especially valuable because he understands communities and schools from both sides. As a young person who benefited from it, and as the CEO now responsible for running communities and schools at that scale, he can speak to the intimacy of one trusted relationship and to the staffing, data, partnerships, and evidence needed to support thousands of those relationships. In the first part of our conversation with Ray, he takes us back to adolescence, a young person with real aspirations but no clear map, someone who saw school as a place of possibility while carrying family responsibility, economic pressure, and the uncertainty of life in a mixed status household. The central idea is trust, but not trust as an instant feeling. Ray shows us trust as something built through consistency. Mrs. Reyes stayed present from his sophomore year through graduation. She offered opportunities, but she also asked questions, listened without judgment, understood what a first-generation college decision might mean for Ray's family, and helped Ray reinterpret experiences once carried as shame into sources of identity and strength. In an earlier episode, episode 3, John King described a teacher, Mr. Osterweil, who made John's classroom safe, nurturing, and challenging during an extraordinary difficult period in John's childhood, and said that without that teacher, he probably would not be alive today. Mrs. Reyes played a related role for Ray, a steady adult presence who made school safer, enlarged the future he could imagine, and paired care with real, demanding opportunity. As you listen, notice how practical the relationship is. It includes a summer experience, college guidance, help with an application, and connections to resources. Those actions carry weight because continuity, cultural understanding, psychological safety, and a person who sees both need and possibility hold them together. Ray then begins to translate this experience into the communities in schools model that he now is responsible for. The site coordinator is both presence and navigator, someone who builds a real relationship and who also knows how to connect school and community resources. That is very different from handing a young person a list of program. Our first conversation with Ray leaves us with three questions for our own settings. Who has enough time and continuity to earn trust? Who sees what young people carry beyond the visible school day? And who takes responsibility for making services feel like one coherent support rather than a series of doors a family or youth has to open alone? Ray, thank you so much for joining us. I've had the great fortune of working with communities and schools, and I've seen what you have brought to the organization, both as an educator and a leader, but also somebody who brings his own lived experience as a young person who had benefited from the supports that CIS gave and continues to give. I see CIS, Communities and Schools, as a model for the type of issues we're talking about in this podcast event. How to align services in a manner that addresses the diversity of contexts, the individuality of each person's strengths and needs, and with in a way that is caring, that is relational, that really is human. Before we go into CIS as a model and what we can learn from it, I want to begin with you as a young person on San Antonio's South Side. I've heard you describe yourself as a very good tightrope walker because you and your family had so many things that had to get right for you and for them in order for you to succeed. And I can add that my own experience. Even though I was a working class kid, I was not at that point in life. But when I started in the work in programs where I was working with people who really had much less resources, I then learned what it's like when you are juggling all the time, when you just things are much more out of control. Not because of the strengths of you or the people around you, but because of the exigencies of the situation you're in. So, what was happening in your life that your school might not have seen, and how did Mrs. Reyes, the CIS site coordinator who worked with you, and I've learned from you, continues to work in CIS, come to understand both what you needed and what you were capable of?
Thank you, David. That's a really great question, and it allows me to get out of my current reality and to imagine a world in the early 2000s when I was in a different place as a young person. But describe the experience of what it was like as a kid growing up on the south side of San Antonio. My parents didn't make much, and I didn't know much about whether I was poor or not, but I became very clear about that actually when I was taking stock of all of the advantages of government services and opportunities my parents would take advantage of, whether that was the WIC services for healthcare or the SNAP benefits for food. I'm realizing now as an adult that you have to qualify for those programs and you have to hit certain thresholds. And growing up with a family of five, and my mother had me when she was 19, had my sister when she was 17. There were challenges that we experienced growing up in a community that often blocked you from thinking about anything else but maybe survival. So school was such a reprieve from a lot of that, a bit of an escape, a place where I could find some social connection. But it wasn't an escape from everything because I was always dreaming as a kid. And these were things that dreams start to take the imagination of what you can put in front of you or what you can imagine. And that was probably a pretty closed circuit system. And I would not think about life after high school. I would think about what it'd be like to get a job and to help my family support their work. And one of the other things that was really weighing on my mind as I was a middle school student and then ultimately getting to high school where I would have found Mrs. Reyes in Communities and Schools was I lived in a mixed status home, and that's a term that I find myself describing more and more to folks about a parent who is documented and one who is not. And there's a sense of anxiety and mistrust that you can have as a young person navigating institutions, going to doctor's appointments, talking to professional officials at school or at the city who are asking you and your parents for information. And I remember when we were qualifying for some of these programs where my mom would apply, it would be that we would have to start talking about what we earned, what we didn't earn, who's living in the house. And there is so much just moderating what was a safe space, what was not a safe space. So, what Mrs. Reyes, who I met as a sophomore in high school at South San High School on the south side of San Antonio, would have found in me was just a person who was really trying to picture what was next, what was possible, somebody who was grappling with my own identity, and somebody who was also trying to run away from the world around me. And I say I had aspirations, but I had no definition to what that aspiration looked like, if it was to be called anything but success. Success in my mind was leaving home, getting as far away as possible from where I was, but I didn't know how to get there. I didn't know where I would go. And so growing up, going to school and finding people who you could trust was difficult. And dealing with the kind of the anxieties that I had in who I was, what I could and couldn't accomplish, what I could and couldn't achieve. And Mrs. Reyes was somebody that was referred to me by both a teacher and a friend. And one of the most sort of comical ways to think about this is you don't know who to trust, but you trust your friends and they refer you. And somebody said, there's this person, she's in the third wing. I think she works for the school. Her name is Mrs. Reyes. And she helped me be part of this summer program where I got to tell my parents I was going to sleep somewhere else Monday through Friday. It's a college experience, but really you just get to camp out and get to be away from home. You don't have to pay anything for it. So I was like, sign me up. Where is she? I'll go to her third wing and get to meet Mrs. Reyes if she'll give me a chance to be away from home over the summer. And she was enrolling kids in a college exposure. And you would think maybe we're traveling to the Northeast or traveling across the state. I was traveling 10 minutes from my home to the West Side Community College campus that was offering this program. And so there was so the preliminary steps of, oh, okay, this person is offering me something. She sees me, she's building a relationship. But I would have known Mrs. Reyes for about 3 years. And starting that sophomore year was the beginning of, could I trust this person and can she help me? And her proving time and time again with consistency, showing up on campus, somebody I could come and turn to, somebody I could talk to about my family, about my father, about how I experienced shame in who I was, and how she turned all of that on its head and made me feel prideful about who I was, related to me with her own experience. And you think about school being a place where you're constantly graded and evaluated. That's not what I got with somebody who I just was building a relationship with. And I never felt a sense of high stakes and maybe I could really dive deep with this person and they could help me. So there's a lot in that, but that's what it was like growing up. And crazy story is that now I get to lead the organization. And Mrs. Reyes said it was so strange when we found out that you were the CEO of the organization because you were the student and now you're kind of my boss in some ways. So it's been a fun experience, but thank you for letting me take the lens of that 14, 15, 16-year-old who met Mrs. Reyes.
I'm glad you took the lens because you probably said the word trust at least 10 around 10 times in the conversation, and that's so important and to young people. To places. Lots of research has been about relational trust in schools, but it tends to focus on relational trust between principals and teachers, maybe sometimes between families and teachers, but it rarely talks about the importance of trust and relational trust as a piece of it, but it's at only one piece between young people who dispositionally, in spite of all their optimism, are at a point within their lives where they tend to be suspicious of adults and other people. How one can break through that and establish the type of trust that enables the relationship that you had with Mrs. Reyes to be that safe place and that enriching place. And that expanding place that stayed with you through the 3 years in high school. And that was very important. Anything else you'd want to add about what she What were the, you know, think back again when you've just met her. On the one hand, she had goodies to offer, right? So that was great. But what else was she doing in the way in which she gave the goodies that really gave you some sense that, yeah, this is somebody I might be willing to expose myself a little in front of?
Yeah, I think what she created, and I think that we don't talk enough about the consistency. And I think about it now as an executive who oversees a large workforce, and the question of how long can you keep your staff translates to me of how long I had Mrs. Reyes. And she was with me my entire high school career, from sophomore to junior to senior year. And it wasn't the first week or month or maybe even the first semester where I said to myself, this is somebody I can really trust and build a relationship with. It was the consistency of seeing her next year, the understanding that she was working with me and my classmates, bringing us together, posing questions to us about what do you want to do this year? How are you challenging yourself? What are you afraid of? That those were all entry points that I don't see where I could have gotten those from other adults, perhaps on that school campus. I certainly wasn't finding the time to have those kinds of in-depth conversations with my high school counselor, who was seeing myself and 600 other students. Mrs. Reyes was somebody who always had time for me and unilaterally reached out to me, and I unilaterally reached out to her, but it wasn't something that I crossed that bridge of trust from the first instance. But when it came time to thinking about, look, Mrs. Reyes, I've got this situation with my father. Nobody in my family's ever applied to college. I'm not sure it's for me. I'm afraid of going away to school. She's prompting me and telling me, actually, I've seen your grades. You should write the essay about your father to Stanford University. I bet they would find that a kind of level of depth of what the kind of student they want. And I was not in a place to say, like, I know anything about what a place like Stanford University, which will ultimately accept me, would want. But I didn't think enough of myself to call anything that I had experienced in my life worth writing about or being valuable. And yes, at first there was an initial conversation of this person might help me with one thing, but the consistency over time, and I don't think we talk about what it feels like to be psychologically safe. We talk about the term often and creating psychologically safe environments for students, for teachers, for educators, but the level of risk it takes for a student who feels ashamed of something and to walk through a journey about feeling prideful about who you are and where you come from, man, I don't know who or what curriculum would have pushed that out of me, but just an in-depth relationship with somebody who I really trusted.
That is so important. Schools are, for all students, emotionally high stakes. And at the same time, when you're balancing the types of issues that you had to balance, when you're juggling tightrope walking, that's the word you used, it's even more important to be able to experience that zone of safety. When you talked about your 3 years with Miss Reyes, what you're also talking about is something that a great Stanford educator now at the Learning Policy Institute, Linda Darling-Hammond, talks about as looping. And while young people who go to schools that have looping, in fact, in the next episode that we have that focuses on the UCLA Community School, people will see how looping is very important for multilingual learners. But at the same time, even if San Antonio's schools did not have looping, what you did have was a person who was with you all that time. And that's really very important. So there's so much in what you've said here. And if we have time, I'd like to come back to it. But I think we probably want to go into other things as well. So, in as a CEO, as you've described CIS, you call the site coordinator, the Mrs. Reyes of CIS, both a presence and a navigator. That's a wonderful language. A caring adult who becomes a single point of contact, who assesses needs and strengths comprehensively, connects school and community resources, and Tears Services, TIERS, for people listening to my New York Brooklyn accent, not students. CIS also asked that its staff express care, provide support, share power, offer challenge, and expand possibilities. All those things that you just said, Mrs. Reyes did. That sounds very different from simply referring a young person to several programs. So it, and in fact, even though you got to visit the schools, there was a lot more there. Drawing on your own experience, how do those elements come together so that a young person like yourself and their family experience support as cohesive, as aligned, and as genuinely responsive to them? And I would say, and respectful of them.
Yeah, this is an important question that reminds me about the real origin story for our organization, Communities and Schools, and the words of our founder. You described our CIS site coordinators as both a presence and a navigator, and that it isn't just a distribution and random acts of programming that are happening that this person is putting together. And so, to use the terms that my founder, co-founder Bill Milliken was using in the 70s, before the science of learning and development, before the science of whole child, he was beginning this movement to say, it's not going to be programs that are transforming young people's lives, it's relationships. And what we need to do is create the conditions for those relationships to thrive inside a school. And so he said at the time in the 70s that they were going to build a 100-year plan because it wasn't enough to be a 2-year, 4-year program dependent on election cycle or a mayor or a governor or president. This had to be a transformation of how schools were designed and built because we needed to find a way to bring relationships back into the school because so much of the focus had been about just the cognitive, just the academics. Then it would transform into just the ability to measure and test. And so, if he had one overarching theory to what a site coordinator today could look like, should look like, there was a bit of separation of duties and responsibilities of what a site coordinator could do to not be reporting to the needs of a school's proctoring or tests or support, so that Ray, myself, as I gone through the program and the students who interact and engage with CIS, are not feeling like they're being graded. They're feeling like they're actually given an opportunity to build a real and genuine relationship with somebody who is actually trained to understand how to not only diagnose and assess the resources in a school that are available, but those in the community. Our founder would say oftentimes is that there is a sometimes not just students, but people in general need a PhD in systems to navigate all of the nonprofits, the community resources, the government programs, that having that one person understand how to connect that and bringing it inside schools to serve students really is playing the role of the conductor. And so, if the violins and the pianos and the strings are all in 5 different areas of town on the south side of San Antonio, my job is to make sense of that, to bring it to the right students. And while I was getting college advising, some financial support, or connection to a program over the summer, some of my other students were dealing with issues around abuse or substance abuse in the home, loss of a loved one. They were dealing with legal issues or mental health issues, suicidal ideation. And that being a that person in that role, understanding how to be a bit of a Swiss Army knife is, yes, about the tactical assessments of a community and the nonprofits and the resources available to bring inside schools. Can I work through the red tape to bring them in? But then can I break through in deep relationships with many young people who may not be willing to give me the diagnosis for what's really wrong? Because all I see right now as a psych coordinator is 5 teachers have referred David to me because he has been disruptive and fighting in class. And it took me 6 months to realize that there has been abuse in the home. So it's not a disruptive student we're dealing with. We're dealing with a safety issue. And that ability for somebody to be inside a school who can sift through, navigate, wait patiently, focus on a caseload that is manageable and not overburdened. That's the science of the work and how we deploy it with some implementation. But it is, in many ways, a kind of experience now that we have been able to pull together over now 5 decades. But on that theory that a student can't get turned on to learning until they're turned on to living. And sometimes living is the hard part. And we know that from our principals, we know that from our superintendents. We know this is something that we can no longer ignore. And so it's a redesign, it's a rethinking. And I Glad you brought up Linda Darling Hammond at Stanford, who's been talking about this for quite some time with leadership across the country. And we just haven't been catching up. And founders like Bill Milliken, who've been talking about this since the 70s, the 80s, through the 90s, trying to expand this work. I think it's possible that we have arrived at a moment where sometimes I say the most powerful element is an idea whose time has come. And I think the time has come for this work. This time has come for understanding developmental relationships, their role in school, and their role in the permanent design of schools.
Your metaphor of the tightrope walker, which requires some balance and balancing, probably also works for the coordinators because of the fact that they both have to have that technical knowledge that you're talking about. They're the ones who have to know what are the connections, but they're not just the conductor on a train getting people in the into the car. What they are is a conductor who is trying to make real music and therefore getting into the heart of the person who they're engaging. And to be able to both make sure the trains run on time for people, but at the same time that people feel heard and that you're hearing them so you can make the trains run on time for them is probably even more important.
Yeah, that's absolutely right, David. I would extend even this. There's a tightrope walking that happens even for some of our educators, teachers who we work with often, who say, look, I care about my work and I care about my curriculum, my academic goals for the year and for the goals of the students. And I am bothered by the idea that I can't go further with a student who I know is struggling with something that is much deeper than the book we're reading or much deeper than the algebra that we're learning. And that I cannot make space for that breaks my heart as an educator because I want to break through. But not having, say, a resource or a person who can focus on that tells us that we are not thinking about the big picture when we recognize that learning, that development, that safe communities, spaces where relationships can thrive. Again, the science of learning and development is clear on this. And I think the notions are catching up by just about every stakeholder in the system. That the way we've done things haven't been working for all students. And the tightrope walking that I refer to is what it felt like as a student, knowing that there was no margin for error. And as Mrs. Reyes and I were working and connecting, and she told me, look, you need to do well in school, you need to stay out of trouble. That was hard. Staying out of trouble for a kid in a neighborhood like the one I grew up with, saying no to things, saying no to friends who were walking down a different path than I was, in my mind, you could not make a single mistake. Some of that to do with resources. Like if I was picked up for having any substance on me, like I had no lawyer in the family who was going to help clear that charge for me. And getting to a place like Stanford where you recognize that actually there is so much different margin of errors for some people based on resources and where they grew up and who their parents were. And so when you're thinking about the role of a site coordinator working with these kids who are tightrope walkers with very little margin for error because society will paint them a certain way or they will be weighed down by one very singular mistake that they make as a sophomore in high school, you realize the stakes. And so tightrope walking, whether it's the right metaphor or not, I think about it because that's what it was like having to feel like you had to run this game perfectly if you were going to find any level of success. And that if you didn't, you tripped once. That's it for you. But that is a mistake of gargantuan proportions when we think about who has access to the American dream.
Oh, it's also rock climbing and rock climbing without rope. And that role is very important.
There's a